It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Impeachment, the Iowa caucuses, and the State of the Union. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The long impeachment saga is over. By a party-line vote, with one exception, President Donald Trump was acquitted of charges of abuse of power and obstruction of justice. While the trial wrapped up, the president gave his State of the Union address, what only can be described as an acrimonious atmosphere. And then, of course, if that was not enough, they were still counting the results of the Iowa caucuses as the Democratic presidential candidates campaigned in New Hampshire. To take a look at what happened this week in our studio this morning, John Barkovich, the local Republican here in Wicomico County, Barry Tillman, former mayor of Salisbury, a Democrat, and Michael Laughlin, political science professor at Salisbury University. Welcome to you all.
Morning.
So, well, John, I'm going to start with you since it's your guy there. He got acquitted, and he had a State of the Union, and he did all kinds of things, and as we should say,
it's the first time
John,
he didn't call the Washington Post fake news.
I see, yes. John is holding up the Washington Post, is acquitted. So what is what's your take on the overall impact of the impeachment process? Obviously, there's some political wins and losses, but also, what does it mean, I think, in the long term, do you think?
Well, I'm looking forward to another impeachment because I'd love to see the president's numbers go at least another 10%, because they've only gone up from 39 to 49. So if we have another impeachment out of the House, we can probably get above 55% and guarantee his reelection. So that would be one thing. The week, it's been a great week for Donald Trump, and it's been a great week for Republicans. We had the acquittal. We had the State of the Union, where he did a masterful job bringing people there that represented the things that he wants to get done. And then it was clear that everybody could watch the Democrats sit on their hands as everybody stood up and cheered for a young black lady who's going to get get money to go to the school of her choice. We see a child who wants to be a spaceman. It went on and on and on, and we never saw any reaction on the part of Democrats. So the State of the Union, and capped off by ripping the speech up, which was planned, wasn't the last minute. And then finally, if that wasn't enough, he goes to the prayer breakfast and kind of brings forward the whole concept of, I'm really happy that we've accomplished the task, and maybe now we can get the fake news off and start doing stuff.
Barry Tillman, what was your take? Obviously much different.
Well, my take on the week was very different. I do agree with John that it was a good week for the Republicans. I found the State of the Union very much like one of a Trump's rallies, only he was scripted more than he is at one of his rallies. But, I mean, what he said, he stood up there and said, among other things, I mean, I'm waiting for the fact-checking to finish on that, but he stood up there and said, I will save your pre-existing conditions, and yet he's got lawsuits in states to remove Obamacare, which guarantees, or the Affordable Care Act, I will call it, that guarantees pre-existing coverage for pre-existing conditions. And I think that it showed, the State of the Union showed one thing. Donald Trump is very good at choreographing prime time. And it also showed us what the State of the Union is. And the State of the Union is dangerously fractured because you've got Donald Trump and the Republicans blindly following him when they sit there and they know what the facts are, and yet they sit there and punctuate it every 30 to 60 seconds of his address with applause and chants of four more years. This is the Congress of the United States. This is not a rally in Hoboken or, you know, Altoona. So I was disappointed. I was disappointed in it. It's very typical, and I think laudable, to bring people in to illustrate graphically what your agenda, what your program is going to be. But I mean, the little fourth grader, I mean, I was very happy she's going to perhaps have access at a better education. But why aren't we talking? And then Betsy DeVos, you know, clapping her hands, who's never been in a public school classroom. And I think that what we need to talk about is public school that's better for everyone, not just someone that happens to come up on the president's radar scope. And, you know, I think, but the Iowa caucus was a debacle, and that shows, gives the Republicans a little arrow in their quiver. And I think that Donald Trump's performance at the prayer breakfast was absolutely shameful, deplorable, disgusting. And I think it was only outstripped by those who didn't get up and say, no, Mr. President, you're wrong. You know, he took issue with the guy who said you should pray for your enemies. He wasn't, and he says, no, I think you're wrong. He's not telling him he's wrong. He's telling him Jesus Christ is wrong. And you're, I mean, I am by no means an expert. I have taught adult Sunday school for 30 years. So I do have a familiarity with the scriptures, and I just think that it's very sad that the Republicans, both in Congress and across the nation, have subordinated their scriptural commitment to Christ, their hearts that they have given to Christ. They have sublimated that for trusting, as the 20th Psalm, one of my favorites, said, trusting in horses and chariots instead of the Lord.
I want to also to bring in now Jeremy Vanook. He is with the Center for American Progress. So, Jeremy, I wanted to get your sense about what you, first of all, in terms of the impeachment process, it obviously ended with his acquittal with a party line vote. One person, of course, Senator Mitt Romney, voting to convict on the first abuse of power charge. What did you make of the impeachment process itself?
Thanks for having me. First off, I would say that I found the impeachment process, the way that it ended, to be somewhat grotesque. To see the parade of Republicans who stood up there, several of whom flat out admitted that Trump did exactly what he's been accused of. You know, you had Lamar Alexander, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Richard Burr, Rob Portman, you had Ben Sasse, who effectively said, we acknowledge that Trump withheld aid to Ukraine and that he did it to force them to announce investigations of his political opponents. And yet, they condone it. They voted to acquit. They effectively said, we are signing off on not only what Trump has done, but what Trump will do. Because we've seen before, you know, he is going to be, if anything, emboldened. He was emboldened when the fact that he stood on that stage in 2016 and said, Russia, if you're listening, I want you to hack Hillary Clinton's emails, that resulted in no accountability from the Republican Party. And he's going to be emboldened that his extortion scheme toward Ukraine is also going to leave him facing no accountability because this party is so totally in his pocket.
Do you think this makes impeachment irrelevant in the sense of removing a president? That is, we see this sort of hyper-partisanship. We certainly saw it, obviously, with the Clinton situation, although the alleged crimes are different. Do you think that impeachment as a vehicle to chastise a president is now moot?
I think to a certain extent it is. I think that we heard over and over from the constitutional law professors who testified before the House Judiciary, for example, if this is not impeachable, then really nothing is. And Trump's legal team was effectively laying the groundwork for nullifying impeachment. They got up there and they said over and over, you know, Alan Dershowitz came out and lit his reputation on fire for this claim that all constitutional scholars basically think is absurd, that a president can pursue any quid pro quo that he wants to ensure his reelection as long as he believes that it is in the national interest and he doesn't trip over, you know, an established violation of law. But not only that, you had Jay Sekulow and Pat Cipollone and Hirschman and Purpura going up there and saying, you know, how can you vote to impeach a president in this economy and, you know, this close to an election? And I just wanted somebody to ask them, how far away from an election does it have to be for us to consider impeaching a president for something as blatantly, flagrantly wrong as what several Republicans even, and I'm not even talking about Mitt Romney, admit he did?
Well, in terms of the Republican Party, one of the observations was that many senators who apparently admitted privately that certainly he crossed the line, as it were, in terms of what should be done. But there was a suggestion that the Republican senators were voting out of fear and that the Republican Party has begun to be fearful of what at least the president would do, or and for that matter, his supporters in this era. What about that idea that that it's not now a matter of just simply whether something was right or wrong, or whether institutional issues are concerned in terms of what the Senate should be able to do or not do in terms of a check on the president, but that fear has taken over one of our parties.
Yes, and this was one of the things that I found the most galling throughout the whole process is, you know, when House Manager Adam Schiff stood on the floor and basically pointed to an article that said that Trump's people had warned Republicans that there would be heads on pikes if they voted against him. And there was all of this very performative outrage. You know, one of the senators said, I was visibly shocked, which I don't think if you are actually shocked, you describe yourself as visibly shocked. But then, you know, now the votes have happened, and we're seeing that exactly what that article said was 100% true. What does Trump do after the vote? One of the first things that he does is he starts attacking Mitt Romney, the one senator in American history who's ever voted to convict and remove a president of his own party.
Michael?
Jeremy, one of the thoughts I had in response to your more pessimistic notion about that impeachment as a power is finished. Perhaps one other way of looking at it, however, is that, well, let me put it in question form. Do you think that the House, in hindsight, should have refrained from pursuing impeachment? Or do you think, when all was said and done, that they did their duty, and even if they anticipated that Trump would be acquitted, but that they did their duty, and we are better off as a country, as a constitutional democracy, because of it?
I would say that I think that they did their duty more so than just about anybody in the Trump era, in that they fought what they knew was a losing battle, you know, in a very Clarence Darrow-esque manner, that they made sure that the fact pattern was laid out, that the case, however futile it may be, that history will look back and they will see that these proceedings happened, they will know that Trump was impeached, and they will see that the House laid out as best as it could, and I thought they did a fantastic job, the case against the president, even if they knew that Senate Republicans would quail in the face of the prospect of actually doing their duty and voting to convict Trump.
John?
Jeremy, then, the impeachment went to a jury. That was the Senate. The Senate decided to acquit. And then there's another jury, a bigger jury out there, and that's the American populace. How do you explain the increase in Trump popularity since the beginning of the impeachment to today? If in fact, this was such a great case, Clarence Darrow himself presented it.
I think that what you have to do is you also have to look at polling on questions about, did Trump do something wrong? Did Trump do something illegal? Did Trump deserve to be impeached? And those polls actually show that the American public supported this. 75% of the American public believed that the Senate should have called witnesses in the impeachment trial. You know, that's something that I think pretty clearly shows that the American people understood what was actually going on, and that this wasn't, you know, something that was driving support toward Trump, that it was actually making the case to the public. There was a statistic I saw that the majority of independents, the further the impeachment investigation and the trial went on, were more and more convinced that Trump had done something wrong. And to be honest, that doesn't comport with your interpretation that this is actually driving people toward Trump.
You're denying the poll.
No, the poll results are saying. I'm saying that there are polls on multiple different issues.
Right.
I think that you can claim that there was this inexorable rise because of impeachment. I think there are complicating factors to that.
Okay. There were so many people that wanted to see, as you say, the poll that said they wanted to hear about impeachment. Then how do you describe the number of people that actually watched the impeachment process on TV?
I think that Senate Republicans made it as difficult as possible to watch.
Okay.
I think that they created a format that made sure that it would go on well into the night. You know, I was staying up until 10 and 11 p.m. at my computer typing away, making sure that, you know, I caught every single minute of it. But I understand that most people aren't available to spend 9 hours, 10 hours a day just watching government proceedings.
Understood.
Barry?
Well, I think that one of the things, and I don't take issue with the poll, but one of the comments I did hear about the poll that put the president at 49% approval rating is kind of an outlier. So I'd want to see a trend on that, you know, before. But I also think that a lot of the people didn't watch all of the impeachment. I'm a junkie, so I watched a lot of it. But I found that, and I mean, I back in 1973, I was, you know, right there after I put my son, who's now 47, down for a nap, watching the Watergate hearings. I think it got to a point where it was just so difficult to watch because you were listening to, especially in the actual Senate portion of the trial, you were listening to Pat Cipollone, who arguably could be a material witness in all of this, and he's a defense attorney, and you're thinking, something doesn't ring kosher about that. And then you've got Alan Dershowitz saying, well, if the president views his reelection as being in the nation's self-interest, he's able to do whatever he wants to do in order to ensure that that happens. I mean, I think you had to withdraw for a while or just face the strong possibility that the top of your head might blow off. But there's no question that a lot of polls that worked their way through the pipeline during the whole several-month process showed an increasing amount of Americans who believe the president should be impeached, believe the president should be impeached and removed, and an extraordinary number of people wanted to, as the point was just made, wanted to make sure that there were material witnesses who had actually been in the room when some of this was happening.
Jerry, let me ask you this. I appreciated the overwhelming evidence and the detail that the House managers went through. I mean, it was, hour after hour after hour. And I was just wondering whether or not it got too complicated, that you saw a piece of it, but only a small piece at any given time, and that if you were tuning in, unless you were following all of it, some of the pieces, they were sort of interesting, but it maybe was too complicated as a television production.
I think that the underlying story is fairly simple. You know, the president wanted these announcements of investigations. He knew what his leverage was, the White House meeting and the hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid, and he was willing to withhold them for as long as he needed to in order to force these announcements. I do take your point, though, that especially when you have 24 hours to fill, and when those 24 hours are being filled in 8-hour increments, it is easy to lose the plot. You know, if you picked up at one particular half hour, you would hear a case made about one small corner, about the firing of Marie Yovanovitch, or about the decision-making process at OMB that doesn't necessarily encapsulate the totality of what the president did. But to a certain extent, that's true of any case that's ever presented.
I want to turn, by the way, to one of the emphasis that the White House legal team put, which was on Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, making the case over and over again that there was some form of corruption. And if you were looking at it and you listened to it, it certainly seemed that there was something there, or at least certainly something to impugn former vice president's own reputation. What did you make of that effort by the White House team, and do you think it was effective?
There's a Yiddish word that I think applies here. It's chutzpah, which means the confidence of the man who has murdered his parents and throws himself upon the courts for mercy. And that's the word that was running through my head when I heard these attacks on Joe Biden, these conspiracy theories raised again and again. You know, Kurt Volker is somebody who the Republicans wanted called in the House, who testified that what Giuliani was pursuing were conspiracy theories. And for this president's legal team to mount the offensive that, you know, he only cared about corruption, that Joe Biden was so corrupt when you have, you know, Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka and Eric Trump, who are pursuing deals around the world with people like, you know, the Mammadovs in Azerbaijan, who have ties to Iranian money launderers in Georgia and Panama, in these hotbeds of corruption where every red flag for the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act would be raised. The fact that they are claiming that this is all about this non-existent, debunked conspiracy theory about corruption by the former vice president really was a lot of chutzpah.
I want to turn to something else because in related to Biden, that is that this idea that the president felt, and he said it the other day, he was so concerned about Joe Biden that he talked to the Ukraine. He said this is a kind of corruption that certainly a president should act on. And there's his belief in that fact. And so if you move back just from Biden alone, what do you think the impact is of the idea that the president can, ask a foreign government to investigate an individual or individuals, and B, this seeming direction to the Justice Department, where he asks the Justice Department to, say, investigate a given set of circumstances, when at least in recent years, the Justice Department has tended to be somewhat independent. In other words, we seem to be getting a situation where the prosecutorial and judicial systems are being used for political purposes, or at least at the whims or at the desire of the president.
Yeah, I find that to be very worrisome. And, you know, the case that is being presented that he brought to the Ukrainian government, first off, it didn't go through anything resembling proper channels. There are ways for investigations to be opened and announced and pursued that aren't the president calls up the president of another country and tells him to talk to his personal lawyer and the attorney general, although the borders between those two are, I think, a little vaguer than they have been under previous presidents. But also what we saw yesterday is this announcement from the Department of Justice that any investigation into a potential presidential candidate by the Department of Justice must now go through top DOJ leadership, must now go through effectively Bill Barr. And I think that he has an extremely worrying record, not only under Trump, but also in his previous stint as Attorney General, of effectively acting as, you know, the president's stone wall, that he is there to, you know, stop the investigations that the president doesn't want, as he did with Iran-Contra, or push the ones that the president does want, as with his jet-setting around the world trying to pressure foreign governments to give him non-existent dirt on the Mueller investigation.
Before I hand it over to Mike again, what about the idea of the Justice Department investigating those people who may surround, say, a particular political campaign, particularly presidential campaigns, an issue that the Justice Department clearly was grappling with during 2016? That is a much touchier issue, it seems to me, than just simply the garden variety investigation of, say, someone or an individuals who are attached to, say, some foreign power or intelligence operation. That intelligence operations seem to sort of shift into the at least some of the periphery, anyway, of the Trump campaign, of a presidential campaign. What about that dividing line? Because we're very we're very sensitive to the idea, and I can understand some of the people, for instance, even the Trump campaign, being very sensitive to the idea of the Justice Department in any form investigating a presidential campaign.
Absolutely. And I think that that's actually a very telling comparison as to just how long the process that has been pursued toward Ukraine has been. When you look at what the Obama administration did in 2016, they basically followed procedure to the letter, almost, in my opinion, I would argue, to a fault, in that the investigation was kept completely quiet. It was done, you know, specifically with the intent of not tripping alarms, of not resulting in the American public even knowing that there was an FBI investigation into Trump until months after he took office. You know, you saw that they were trying to make sure that it did not become politicized, that it did not result in some bombshell. In fact, the most famous headline from the campaign when it came to Russia was the exact opposite. It was that the FBI did not see any links between Trump and Russia. And since then, you know, we've seen report after report, 272 contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, or people who could reasonably be argued to be working for the Russian government. And it was kept quiet from the public because the decision was made that potentially politicizing the Justice Department was too big of a risk for them to take.
Mike?
Jeremy, I want to shift the focus on what happens from this point forward, particularly as it has to do with the role of the media now going forward. It seems to me, just to use the language of, are we in this post-truth era? where we know the truth. We know the truth of what Trump did, and we know that it was a flagrant abuse of power and that he should have been ejected from office. However, going forward, it's pretty clear that the propaganda, disinformation campaign that will go forward from Trump, as he illustrated in his State of the Union address, but also through the Republican Party going forward, that as I just read in the Post this morning, that apparently Grassley and some other Republicans are going to pursue the Hunter Biden an investigation into that issue, track, and knowing full well that there's no evidence there, but that he's really essentially carrying out what Giuliani was doing previously. It seems to me that falls then on the media now has a major responsibility here, whether it will carry forward essentially the disinformation campaign or whether it actually now has an even greater burden with regard to actually telling us the truth and reinforcing the truth about these matters rather than falsehoods.
Absolutely. And that's something that I think has been worrying me throughout the Trump presidency, especially as the 2020 election heats up. There are signs, I think, of some growth and some learning. You know, Peter Schweitzer, the, I would say, glorified opposition researcher whose book propagated conspiracy theories about the Bidens in 2018, but also in 2016, the Uranium One conspiracy theory, which, again, repeatedly debunked about the Clintons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His new book came out about 2 weeks ago, and I haven't seen anything resembling the level of coverage that he got for Clinton Cash or for Secret Empires for his new book.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think there are real sincere concerns about the media's continued susceptibility to both sides' issues, to treat the fact that one party says one thing and the other party
yes.
says another as representative of there's some truth in the middle, rather than what we've seen, which is that the Republican Party is willing to embrace and propagate disinformation, conspiracy theories, debunked allegations against their opponents in order to potentially win elections.
John?
Yeah, Jeremy, then, just as sort of a follow-up to that concern, if I was a Biden supporter, would I be today saying that impeachment helped me, or did impeachment make it worse for my candidate by keeping his name in the news for the last 6 months?
From what I've seen, the Democratic electorate seems to pretty well understand that what's going on, that these allegations against Biden are conspiracy theories. I think that you can make a lot of arguments for and against Biden's candidacy. I think that there are legitimate arguments that Iowa, the caucus format specifically, don't play to his strengths as a candidate such as they are, and really play to his weaknesses as a candidate such as they are. But, you know, I do have to say, I think it's interesting that this is, I believe, my third time on this show, and that question has come up basically all three times that I've been on the show, and I think that it speaks a lot to the perceived effect of these conspiracy theories and the fact that Trump, there's no way that he would not have understood when he raised these conspiracy theories with Zelensky, when he raised them in the media, would not be doing so with the understanding that they were hurting somebody he considered a political opponent and a threat for the 2020 election.
We've been speaking with Jeremy Vanook. He is with the Center for American Progress. And Jeremy, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So turning to our local panel here. So in terms of the impeachment, and I'm going to send this to John, because we have Mitt Romney, who searched his soul, as it were, and decided that he had to at least vote for at least one of the counts for conviction. He obviously immediately was attacked, certainly by the President of the United States, as well as others. I think one Trump's son said that he should be kicked out of the Republican Party. What do you make of that his decision, as well as the reaction to it?
Well, it was not long after he voted that the first Mitt quit button showed up. So I think they were somewhat prepared for his vote. It takes a while to get a button made. But in any case, Mitt's not part of, from my point of view, the conservative Republican Party. He has been significantly moderate in his positions, both as in Massachusetts, and subsequent. The only reason he's a Republican governor from Utah, I mean a Republican senator from Utah, is his standing in the Mormon community in Utah, I think, is understood and accepted by many, including myself. I understand that they recognize his capacities and what he did in the past. But I think he was clearly, my perception is he was a Trump hater from the get-go, and his vote did not surprise me.
Do you think it was sincere?
I guess in his heart and mind, he probably felt like he did the right thing. The fact that he voted guilty on one and not guilty on the other suggests that there was some divergence in his concerns going forward with the impeachment process. But I think he made a decision that he thought was the right one for him. I think animosity goes a long way towards his making that vote.
Do you think he should still be part of the Republican Party?
I think it'll be very interesting to see in 4 years when the other senator from Utah, Senator Lee, a very conservative, well-recognized fellow, mounts a challenger who there must be another Mormon in Utah who was a conservative that would run against Mitt.
Well, that'll be interesting. So, Barry, as obviously a Democrat, but what did you make of this exchange that occurred with Romney? I mean, Romney said, in essence, the president is guilty of appalling abuse of public trust. What he did was not perfect. No, it was a flagrant assault on our electoral rights, national security, and fundamental values. And, of course, the president hasn't responded. Basically said that he's slick, slippery, stealthy Mitt Romney, who blew the 2012 election. What did you make of that interchange?
Well, I certainly wasn't surprised. I mean, you know, Donald Trump makes no bones about the fact that, you know, when somebody hits him, he hits back harder. And I think that Mitt Romney should take the advice of my mother when we were suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and she would say, rise above it. You know, let it go. And I think that Mitt Romney's vote was basically a vote of conscience. He went to great lengths to talk about his faith. I think that the argument that he's never really been a conservative is interesting, because if that's the criteria by which we judge people's motives, then Donald Trump was a great conservative when he was supporting Chuck Schumer, and he was pro-choice and giving money to Democrats up and down the ballot until he found a bone to pick with birtherism on Barack Obama. So that's an interesting approach to it. I think that Mitt Romney is more of a moderate Republican. My father-in-law was a lifelong Republican. My husband was also. He is no longer a Republican, but they were both very moderate and conservative in some ways. But I mean, the thing is, I think that Mitt Romney searched his heart, and he gave a very impassioned rationale, and the president gave a very petulant, rebuke that, frankly, if one of my children had done, I would have said, I think you need to spend a little time in your room and consider what you've just said.
Mike, what do you think in terms of the Republican Party? I mean, John indicated a moment ago that he wasn't really a real conservative. He certainly had issues when he went to CPAC, for instance, the conservative gathering, and had to tell people that he was severely conservative, I think was the term that he used. But nonetheless, what do you think this mean in terms, has the Republicans shifted even further to the right, whatever those terms mean?
First, I would encourage everybody who didn't listen to Mitt Romney's speech to either listen to it or read it, because it will go down, I think, historically as one of the most dramatic speeches in this particular period. And what it strikes me that it's hard. I mean, Mitt Romney said himself that his voting record is 80% in support of Donald Trump's agenda. So it strikes me it's rather difficult to suggest that somehow he's out in the hinterland somewhere, that he's gone left and ideologically. I don't think this has anything to do with ideology. I genuinely think that it has to do with a commitment to the principles of the Constitution. That Romney laid out very clearly in three steps why he took apart the president's counsel's presentation, and he just eliminated all three of them and said, you cannot conclude. They did not defend the president effectively, and that the president, the abuse of power was egregious. Hence, on principle, right? He went, and again, this is Romney. He has put his political leverage within the Republican Party out to the wasteland. He's not going to have much leverage in the, at least in the short run, in case. Why would he do this? He would do, he did it, I think, in this case, with on principle. In contrast, I mean, this is the dramatic contrast. In contrast, I think, for the Republican Party, the Republican senators, what they did was allegiance to power over principle. They know. I mean, they're not idiots. They know that Romney is correct, that the House managers brought an effective case. Okay? But they are fearful of this president in terms of their own political futures. And additionally, again, I think we should never lose focus that it is policy agenda is uppermost in this. And so hanging on to power, and Mitch McConnell is quite sophisticated and quite a good strategist, hanging on to power with this particular president, perhaps they can power their way through the next election and remain in power. So the agenda of this particularly very conservative, I would call it a reactionary party at this point. I think that conservatism no longer embraces this. There's nothing conservative of what they did with regard to the Constitution. They are eviscerating the Constitution at this point in time for the sake of power.
Is this Trump's party, John?
Yeah, it's Trump's party, and it's not because of the fear of him, although there may be some.
Right. Well, if
because
he
he's a political power. I'm not denying he's a political power. I'm not denying that.
Right. If you held office, you would be fearful.
But
right?
I mean, you know, I don't know that Collins and Lamar, you know, if they really felt strongly, would could have voted against him. Not been. I mean, Lamar in particular, he's not going to run again. What does he care? But in any case, the reason the Republicans support Trump is not because of the power or fear. It's because of the success he has brought to America, and they see that. They see the judges that they're getting elected. They see the crime bill that went through in a bipartisan way. They see what he's done on the border. They see what he's done for the military. They see what he's done for unemployment for blacks, Hispanics, and women. And they go, you know what? We're not going to argue with success. Yeah, we don't like there. How many times have you heard, I don't like what he does with his tweets, but I still like what he's accomplishing. And so I think that's still the main driver. It's the success he's achieved in terms of the conservative portions of the agenda that he's gotten through. They sure. love the military. They love border. They love ICE. And they love having
kids. We are
kids
in agreement.
We are in agreement.
And the policy agenda is being
is what's
propelled.
Driving them. And so right? I don't think it's the fear of Trump. Okay. I really.
But that's an additional item.
Well, it may be. It may be. But I think.
Because otherwise.
I think the hatred between Trump and Pelosi and Trump and Mitt is significant, real, and never will go away. He holds a grudge.
Does he hold a grudge, Mike?
I don't believe that. I don't think so. I think that, again, I mean, I'm not a religious person myself, but I appreciate that people who are religious really do take it to heart. And I found it convincing when Mitt Romney lays that out, that he is a Mormon. He has a long history of Mormonism, and that's very important to him.
I don't deny it.
He sacrificed power. He sacrificed political power
this
position.
He's dead. For four years, he's going to be a non-entity in the Republican Party.
I agree with you. I think that reasoning leads me to believe that it was on principle. The reality, and this is the question I had for Jeremy, was truth or propaganda, for truth or disinformation. And I think where the Republican Party has gone with Trump is in the whole ocean of disinformation. Okay. They are now the party of propaganda. They are now the party that must claim that they had a trial without witnesses, without documents. Okay, that's what they must claim. And that's difficult terrain, I think, ultimately, for the future.
Okay. Well, can I get back to one question? One quick one from Barry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to assault you. No, because she said the evangelical vote is with Trump. So everything she said about the religious side is just not supported by the facts. Where did evangelicals vote 3 years ago? Did they vote for Trump or Hillary?
They voted for Trump.
And the expectation is even more will this time. Why? Not because of what he did with Romney, whose religion he brought to the bear, or whether or not Pelosi's praying for his health, But he did things with prayer. He did things with abortion. He went to the right to life. I mean, those are things that, mm-hmm. that evangelicals care greatly about, and he has done those things for him. So having said all what we've said about religion and faith and prayer, the evangelicals, again, are looking at the results, not the talk.
Well, I'd like to answer that. Thank you, John, for letting me have the opportunity.
I'm sorry.
I think the evangelicals, I frankly have considered myself one. I've been a member of a Baptist church for 30 years. So, I mean, I believe in faith in God through Jesus Christ, and I believe the scriptures are God's inspired word to us. What profit a man if he gain the world and lose his soul? And I think that's pretty much where we are with Donald Trump. What profits a Christian if they achieve some judges, or if they feel that there's not going to be any more Roe v. Wade, or we're going to have occasional prayer in school, if they support a human being who is just anathema to everything they have been taught in the scriptures? He is, he is a man who says he's never had to ask for forgiveness. Well, the scriptures tell us clearly, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And the reality is that everything he says, what he said at the prayer breakfast yesterday, his demeanor and tone, and what he said in the White House East Room yesterday, was something that there is no Christian that I can even imagine ever having said, I'm hooking my star to that horse, or my horse to that star, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I just think that they're basically subordinating their faith and what they know is right to what they think they're gaining. And as again I say, the scripture is very clear. What profit a man if he gain the world and lose his soul? I wanted to say a couple things. I was glad that Mike brought up the idea of the media. The media is a very important player in this. We've lost the ability of the Senate to police, or to oversee the president. But the media has a responsibility to not just report what the president says and report what Speaker Pelosi says, but to say, now, Speaker Pelosi said this was correct, that was not. And I used to get into philosophical discussions with the Daily Times when they would report something, and they'd say, well, we had two quotes from you and two quotes from somebody else, and what do you want us to do? I said, I want you to tell the truth. I want you, if there's something out there that needs to be said, that's what you're here for. And I think that, the other night the president said, we've had the best growth we've ever had in the history of humanity. And that's simply not true. I mean, growth now is, there's growth, but it's not the best that there's ever been. There have been periods of greater growth during President Obama's administration, during Clinton's. And I think there was arguably there might have been during George Bush's. And let's not even go back to, the post-World War II era. But the thing is that, John is bringing up the conservatives and everything. And I think that's an important point. But I think that the Republic, my father-in-law, one of the last political discussions I ever had with him before he died at 91, he said, they have hijacked my Republican Party. And I think that he was referring to the neo-conservatives and the CPACs and everybody, the Tea Partiers and everything. And he kind of broke ranks to not vote for Congressman Harris because he was so appalled. But I think that what is conservative? I mean, if the Republican Senate and the Republican House like his agenda and what he's accomplishing, first of all, I'd like to clarify exactly what he's accomplishing. But the thing is, what is conservative about getting into bed with Russia and tax cuts that just drive the deficit up? I mean, those were the cornerstones of Republican conservative philosophy, and we've kind of thrown those to the wind. And the president assured us that if we would just pass this tax cut, that everybody would reinvest and their growth would go up to 4, 5, 6%. Well, it ain't anywhere near that. And so I just think that, this idea, well, he's achieving the conservative agenda. He's certainly doing things that some conservatives would like very much. But A, he's not a conservative. And B, there's nothing conservative about a lot of this agenda.
I want to turn now to elections and the Democrats. We had certainly in Iowa, we had what turned out to be caucuses with a mess to it. The latest results, and no doubt, well, maybe they'll change a little, but with 100%, they say now. Buttigieg has 26.2%. Sanders has got 26.1%, basically a tie. Warren comes in at 18%, Biden 15, and then Klobuchar with 12.3. And then as they spring into New Hampshire, and we're going to actually have a debate tonight for New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, the latest poll that I've got in WBZ, Boston Globe, Sussex University, it's a tracking poll. It puts Sanders at 24%, but Buttigieg at 23%. Apparently, he's risen by something like 7% or so. Elizabeth Warren is at 13. Biden is trailing at 11. Let me start with you, Mike. What do you make of the field? I mean, put aside the mess of Iowa for a moment, but what does that say about where the Republican Party is, where the Democratic Party is going?
Well, first, it affirms what election analysts have always argued over the years, in terms of the historical perspective, that chaos or not, Iowa is meaningful and it influences New Hampshire. That even though all the data has been dribbling out, nonetheless, clearly Buttigieg has gotten a boost and is now trending well. This unknown mayor, basically nationally, from Indiana now has gained steam. Few people are surprised that Sanders is doing well also, because he was, he had developed a national following, of course, last time around in 2016, and he's had good organization in Iowa as well. And certainly in New Hampshire, what is more interesting, perhaps, in terms of analysis, is where Biden has fallen. I think that he's not doing well. He didn't do well in Iowa, and he's not doing particularly well now in New Hampshire. And the real question becomes for all these candidates, and this is Elizabeth Warren's problem too, I think, can they survive in terms of their funding? Can they live to fight another day? And what happens with Warren, for example, if she comes in third in New Hampshire? Does she have enough of a donor base for her to continue into South Carolina and into Super Tuesday? And there's a question mark, I think. The same ultimately is with Biden, whereas the money will begin to flow, it begins to flow to winners. So the likelihood is that if indeed that poll holds up in terms of election next Tuesday, I think it is Tuesday. If it's Tuesday, it's New Hampshire. So then that's where the money will flow to Sanders and Buttigieg.
Let me have some follow up, because one of the things that Claire McCaskill, the former senator, made an interesting point, and it's about the lineup here, and that is that coming out at least of Iowa, basically, you've got Buttigieg, Biden, and Klobuchar. If you add them all together, they come up about 53%. Okay, and they tend to be sort of on the whatever the moderate side is, right? As opposed to Sanders and Warren, which only come up attached to about 44%. So it sounds as if the moderates, whatever that may mean, still dominate in terms of the people turning out. Whether they, in the end, they succeed as individuals, another matter. But nonetheless, it seems as if the progressive wing of the party certainly is substantial, 44%, if we're to go by this. But on the other hand, people like Biden or Biden's ilk, as it were, they seem to still be a dominant in the party.
But I take her point, but I think it's that logic is undermined by the problem of Iowa and even New Hampshire. These are unrepresentative states, particularly Iowa, and particularly the caucuses, such that I don't think it's that you get a fair reading by looking at the data on these particular states. If anything, I think it's a long argument within political science about why don't we have a national primary? What are we doing having these essentially white states? It doesn't represent it. The demography is not representative of the Democratic Party. We're not going to get that kind of representation until we get to South Carolina and to Super Tuesday, really. So I think that's overstated. I think she I would say this, however, that I think what it does say, okay, is that to the extent, let me try it this way, that those percentages hold up going forward, but I think things will change in terms of more progressive support later. Nonetheless, what that means in terms of delegate count, I think we have a much greater chance now of a kind of broker convention. We're not going to really know who the winner or the nominee is until far into the future at this point, particularly if Biden's campaign collapses.
I'll turn to you, Perry. One of the things that has been suggested is that because Biden is in the mix, that perhaps crowded out other what might be considered moderate candidates, like, for instance, Harris out of California, for example, or has pushed Klobuchar down because Biden is in the race. What do you make of that mix? Do you think that's true, that Biden may have spoiled it a bit?
I don't know that I'd use the term spoiled. I think that those who are not doing as well, like Amy Klobuchar, who's obviously a very, very talented candidate, I don't think he spoiled it. I think that he's come in there and I take him at his word that he got in there because he thought it was time to return decency to the White House. And, you know, I don't think that he has spoiled their chances. He's certainly complicated their chances. But I don't know where Amy Klobuchar would be today, because clearly I think a moderate element of the Democratic Party is liking Mayor Pete. And, you know, I think that if they had to choose today between Mayor Pete and Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar, I think she'd still be on the bottom of the pile.
John, what do you make of all of this? Obviously, from the Trump folks is that no matter who emerges, they are going to be a socialist. That seems to be
we have to not forget that everybody raised their hand. Right. Healthcare, get rid of ICE. Oh yeah, we're all for that. Medicare for all. Oh yeah, we're all for that. I don't see any moderates on the Democrat side.
Certainly not from your point of view.
Even Bloomberg, who you haven't talked about, right. Who's got the
doesn't care about
money, and we're gonna see him start to show up, and it won't be long. And he may be considered the ultimate moderate of the Democratic side. Biden's gone, okay, and I don't see him coming back. Even if Bloomberg gave him $2 billion, I don't think Biden's coming back. And I'm not sure the Buttigieg is a moderate either. I'd argue with you about that. I don't see any. Okay, Klobuchar, she's moderate only because she's never had a chance to do anything. Having said that, I think Iowa and New Hampshire have been used in the past because they're small states and give all the candidates a chance to get out and kind of give their message. And so it's an initial winnowing of, because remember how many candidates we had to start? What were there, 16, 23?
I think
that's what has appealed to the parties to say, let's start in two small states so we have a chance to get our candidates out and shake hands and face-to-face so they get a real, because later in time they won't have that. Later in time it will be based more on money, because now you're starting to talk about big states. You're talking about multiple states, and then we've already winnowed down. We sort of picked our candidates a little bit. Now the money is being focused, and so I think that's why New Hampshire and Iowa still will be there in some form. Now maybe it's a limited primary where you pick a couple of states to try and get a, because I agree with you, New Hampshire and Iowa do not represent the United States. I mean, there's no way in the world you can look at those two states and say that's a good slice of Americana. It's not. It's far from it. But it is a chance for someone to do a lot of handshaking and small retail politics that you can't get in the big primary. And that's, so I'm not in favor of a national primary. I'm in favor of, let's do something that's a little more representative maybe, and then let's not have any more cauci. Let's have something with a vote that we can ascertain quickly. But a national primary would suggest that there has to be some winnowing ahead of time. And I just don't see that happening if you have it all. If you have 26 candidates running on the Democratic Party in a national primary, I think it's going to be so confusing. You'll guarantee a brokered convention because nobody's going to get votes enough to be the nominee.
Mike, do you think the caucus will survive in Iowa? They're talking about
doomed.
Although it might have to go second because New Hampshire is has pledged itself to be the first primary no matter what. So if Iowa moves itself up, I'm sure New Hampshire will be in December of the previous year.
Right.
Exactly. What do you think?
You know, they've declared the Iowa caucus dead a number of times previously. So perhaps this would be the real nail that in the coffin for the caucus because of the debacle. And I think the pressure, certainly the pressure from the Democratic Party itself, the National Party, perhaps will, because this has caused such the consequence has been so politically troubling, out of disproportionate to the importance of Iowa in terms of number of delegates. That is, you know, it's only 41 delegates coming out of Iowa. So there's no, that's not a major consideration. But because of where it is in the time of the whole dynamic here, that it has a disproportionate influence, not only in terms of the impact on candidates, but the image of the political party itself, whether people can have confidence that Democrats know what they're doing. And I think in that light, it may be the case that the pressure will be on Iowa to close down caucuses and become a primary state as well.
Well, let me say about the idea about caucuses, because there will be a number of them across the country as we move forward. And one of the observations I've always made, particularly about the Sanders case in 2016, was that he won the caucuses, which are a much smaller group of people, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, which won primaries, which required much more effort in large states. Now, I know that the Sanders people feel like, well, the party was working against them. They didn't get a fair shot at it. But the fact of the matter is that Hillary Clinton, whatever her faults are, she won the primaries. Is a primary a better way to do this in terms of?
Absolutely. I think if the goal is we want to ensure that Democrats are be able to express their opinion, their vote for what the candidates they want, that means what you want to do is to maximize the turnout. I mean, you want to approach 100% of the Democrats. You're not going to get that, but and the primary is a much more effective mechanism for doing that than the caucus. I mean, the problem with the caucus is you have only a limited number of people have the time and the energy to go to the meetings, and what that tends to do, it tends to tilt the turnout towards upper educated, higher income people, people with more time, more energy, whereas working class people come home from a job, they're worn out. You know, maybe they can get themselves to go out and vote. You know, it takes them long to vote, right? And if you have 2-week period for them to vote, let's say, there's plenty of time you maximize, and then you get a much better, much more a fulsome expression, I think, of what the Democratic voters, in this case, if they change in Iowa or New Hampshire, want in terms of their candidates.
Finally, Barry, I want to turn to you for just a moment. This tiff that seems to have exploded between the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and the President, mm-hmm. It has become even worse. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, that neither one of them have actually talked to one another since she stood up in the White House and pointed her finger at it. What do you think that means in terms of what we're seeing on Capitol Hill? I mean, it seems as if the whole thing is being frozen out. We saw, as you mentioned a moment ago, the Republicans during the State of the Union would get a clap all the time. It was 4 more years. And, I mean, it just seems as if the political divide is really very sharp in the last minute we got here.
Well, it is very sharp. And I think that I will say, as far as my opinion goes, he should have shaken her hand and she should not have ripped up the speech. And I think that he shouldn't have spoken unkindly about her at the prayer breakfast when she was sitting, you know, a few seats away from him. So obviously, they're the symptom of what's going on. They're the manifestation. You know, when you run a big fever, you might have the flu. And I think they're the fever. And I think that it's difficult to get things done. But I also think that people are disgusted with Washington. The ratings just keep going down for the Congress, and the only way that's going to change that is not to change the rules, but to change the players.
We've been speaking with John Barkovich. He's a local Republican here in Wicomico County. Barry Tillman, former mayor of Salisbury, also a local Democrat. Michael Laughlin, he is a political science professor at Salisbury University. And on the phone with us from Washington was Jeremy Vanuk. He's with the Center for American Progress. I appreciate you all stopping by, chatting with us. And no doubt, John and Mike and Barry will no doubt do this again. And John's got his newspaper up there. Thanks for
it's
listening.
Not fake
this
news
is
today.
You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.